Welcome back once again to season 4 of the podcast. I'm your host, Amanda Blackwood. As many of you know, I wrote my autobiography as a survivor of human trafficking. It's called Custom Justice. But if you didn't know, you do now. Keeping in line with that, this entire season and last season has been focused on interviewing people who did or plan to write about their own experiences as trauma survivors and how they overcame the past. And as much as we all hate commercials, they are a necessary evil these days. This is what keeps the show on the air. You can also show your support by purchasing one of my mini books or donating through PayPal or leaving a review on whatever platform you listen to this podcast on. You can find the links for the books or donation options in the podcast description. As always, a portion of the proceeds go to local organizations that help fight human trafficking. Hey folks, welcome back to the podcast. As always, I'm your host, Amanda Blackwood. I have an incredible guest with me today. I'm super excited to get to know her and to hear her story. She's had quite the journey of recovery, and she's now got her bachelor's degree from college. She's got a master's in social work. She's earned her clinical licenses in social work and substance abuse counseling, is on the board certified diplomat for clinical social work. Holy cow. She's done a lot. Shannon Petrovich is absolutely incredible, and wait till you hear her story. She's going to tell it to you here in just a few minutes. Welcome to the show, Shannon.
Thanks so much for having me, Amanda.
I am really excited to get to know you. When we first started getting to know each other a little bit through Podmatch, your story kind of it resonated with me, and I think a way that so many people can totally understand and, you know, identify with in deep and profound ways. And that's sad to say, because it is, you know, trauma that we're basically talking about, but it's important that we get these stories out there so that people can see that there's a model of somebody who has overcome all of this and done incredible things with their life. So let's start from kind of the very beginning. Where are you originally from? Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Salt Lake City, Utah.
Oh, I grew up for a few years in Ogden, just north of there.
Oh, no kidding.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. So tell us a little bit about what kind of a trauma did you have to experience to set you on this path?
Well, the main trauma that happened to me was in high school, and I attached myself to a very abusive alcoholic boyfriend during my junior year, and it lasted through my senior year and almost into college. So I was very much lost in the fog and unable to get free and unable to really see anything clearly, even though other people around me saw it for what it was. And it took me a few years to realize that I had internalized a lot of negative self-talk out of that, and also out of some other experiences. And then I ended up getting into another negative relationship in my late 20s that was really troubling and really difficult also to get out of. So in my early college years, I thought about, I really wanted to be a doctor or a veterinarian, but I shifted gears into wanting to understand more about what makes us tick internally, emotionally, psychologically, and relationally. So I focused on social work and ended up with my clinical degree and licenses and becoming a therapist. But still, it's taken me years to really figure out what it is that helps us get lost in the fog of toxic relationships and what it takes to get free and clear of it.
Right. And there's so many people who don't understand it and they struggle. Now, I can't tell you how many times I've heard people use the phrase, why didn't you just leave? That is one of the most damaging, most frustrating things I've ever heard. Oh, do you have any words of advice for people that are hearing this?
I do. I think that one of the things that it took me a really long time to figure out is that our own internal self-talk is part of what sets us up for becoming engaged with people who are really toxic to us. And so if we have a toxic relationship within our own selves, we are set up to also attach to people who also will treat us that way. Not to blame the victim at all, but that we do have to look at those dynamics within ourselves that may have been set in motion in early childhood or adolescence. And when those dynamics are set in motion and we don't address them, we might get out of that toxic relationship and then bounce right into another one. And that was one of the things that I really wanted to figure out as I was in this journey. So one of my early therapists said that she wanted me to write down every time that I said something terrible to myself inside my own head. And at first I thought that was a really dumb exercise, but then I realized that I talked to myself constantly, really negatively inside my own head. And it was just horrible. I would never speak to anyone else in the world that way. And so in order to get free, we have to first address the toxic relationship within our own selves and really become compassionate and loving and caring towards ourselves, or we can't ever set boundaries with anybody else.
And that is so important. I grew up in a rather abusive household and my self-esteem was shot by the time I was early teens. Mm. And I started seeking out those abusive relationships too. For one thing, it was what I was familiar with.
Right.
You know, right, I was raised to believe that the people who love you are the people who hurt you. And if they don't hurt you, that means they don't love you.
Right. And that controlling, manipulative, dishonest, hurtful and hateful behavior is familiar or normal. So it isn't that it's comfortable and it isn't that we seek it. It's just that when that happens to us, we're not surprised or shocked or incredulous or righteously angered about it. So when we start to take care of ourselves and we become clean and clear within our own selves, then when somebody is nasty and awful to us, we just step back and say, oh, no, you did not. And we are not about that. And we're not going to stay attached to that person if we have become attached. So it very much is a familiar thing or a resonance that happens. And again, not to blame the victim, but that we don't have good creepo meters and we don't have good defenses and boundaries if we have those negative toxic thoughts and feelings about ourselves inside our own heads.
Right. And healthy boundaries are so important to have too.
Yeah, right. They're critical.
And I've told people before, you know, if I talk to other people the way I talk to myself, I wouldn't have any friends at all.
Right.
People wouldn't tolerate that, you know, and I've gotten over a lot of that. But yeah, that negative self-talk where you convince yourself that you're not worthy.
Right.
It's so dangerous and scary, and it's isolating, sad.
Right. And the psychologists say that we talk to ourselves inside our own head somewhere along the lines of 40,000 times a day. And I don't know who sat and counted all that, but it resonates for me. I think we do. We chatter inside our own heads all the time. And that's normal and healthy if it's positive, encouraging, supportive, compassionate. But if it's toxic and nasty and degrading and discouraging, man, it's nonstop and it's really, really harmful.
Yes. I lived in that same kind of fog for a long time.
Mm.
That's scary. When you were able to get out, did you start seeking help right away or did it take you some time to be able to start recognizing that you needed some assistance?
You know, it's been a journey. And when I was in high school, getting help really wasn't done. You know, that was just that you just didn't, that was for crazy people and you just right. didn't do that. And so
right. Buck up, buttercup.
I didn't exactly. I did not get any help in high school. Then when I went to college, it's kind of funny, but I had a really, really crummy therapist. I hate to say that, but it's true. And that may be part of why I decided to become one, because I thought there's got to be a better way to do this. She was sort of the smile and nod person and never helped me see my patterns and what I was doing and how I was sabotaging good relationships and gravitating back into negative relationships. So I did get help, but it wasn't helpful. And then later on, I got involved with a couple of really, really dynamic therapists. actually a male-female couple who ran individual as well as groups, and that was super helpful.
Wow, that's really cool. I had some pretty horrible experiences with therapists when I was a teenager, and I wouldn't see one again until I was desperate, 39 years old, and not knowing where my life was going and if I was going to survive from one day to the next. That first therapist, again, was terrible. She was unfortunately fairly new to the industry. And with my own personal history, I think I traumatized her more than she was able to help me. And it was awful. But then I was able to find a second therapist, and she was incredible. She was one of those people that's straight to the point. She pulls no punches. So much respect for that. And I think it's also important for people to realize that therapists are there to be able to help. And if you feel like you're not getting help from your therapist, find another therapist that you feel like you can get along with and that you can talk to.
Absolutely. And, you know, sometimes therapists are hurtful. Sometimes they're just innocuous and they don't help. Sometimes they don't know that we need instruction. We need help. We need direction. And, you know, a lot of times I'll talk to people who've been in therapy and I'll ask them what was helpful and they can't identify one thing. And if that's true for you, that's not helpful. If you're just sitting there regurgitating the same thing, how is that helpful? You know, that, yes, it's nice to vent, but that's not the point. You know, you're not going to go to the doctor and just talk about your illness and then go out the door. You have to have some help. And so, you know, that's why when I wrote this book, I created it with journaling prompts throughout so that people could actually do the work and get well.
Right. How do we as a society start to raise awareness about PTSD and mental health and kind of foster a more compassionate and supportive society?
You know, I think it's happening to a large degree. I think it's hugely different than when I was growing up. And it seems to be certainly the awareness around mental health and support around mental health is really improving over the years. And I think even the high profile people that are willing to say that they suffer from anxiety or trauma or depression has been hugely helpful. Also, the high profile suicides is just so shocking because here are people who have access to help and they fall into despair sometimes. And so I think that brings a lot of awareness, sadly, in the wrong way. But
right. Nobody's immune. Doesn't matter how much money you make or where you're living or how your life looks on the outside. Nobody's immune.
Right. And sometimes that can be helpful for people to see, you know, it isn't that I have no money. It isn't that XYZ. It's really, you know, depression is an illness. Anxiety needs treatment. And actually learning skills and practicing those skills is going to make me better. And not doing anything is not going to help.
Right. Now, in your work, you talk with other people who have survived domestic violence and those kinds of relationships. Have you gone through trauma-informed care training for this?
Yes, I've done, you know, just mountains of training over the years. you know, I early on did a lot of training through John Bradshaw's work on healing the inner child. That kind of segued into what we now know as mindfulness and then EMDR training I did. And I use that quite a bit in my practice. And I think that, you know, anyone who is practicing who doesn't have a trauma-informed awareness is missing 90% of the boat. I just don't know how, you know, and a lot of times when I will talk to somebody and they will say, well, I suffer from anxiety and depression. And as I'll talk with them about their lives, I, you know, sometimes they will see it just as a chemical imbalance. And I will say, I would feel anxious and depressed if I lived with that person too. This is not healthy. This is extremely toxic. And the way you're living is horrible. And I know you're toughing it out and you're a trooper, but your anxiety and depression are due to what you're living with right here, right now. Your system is on high fire constantly, fight, right, flight, freeze constantly. And yeah, that, you know, that looks like anxiety and depression in the clinical sense, but, you know, we can't just slap on a Band-Aid. We have to look at where this is coming from.
Right. It's crazy too. There's so many people out there. There's a huge percentage of people who have experienced domestic violence in some way. And while it's the majority of women that are going to be more open to talking about it, it happens to men too.
It sure does. And, you know, toxic relationships come in all shapes and sizes. And a lot of times what men are dealing with is more covert. And so they have a harder time getting out of that fog in a lot of ways. You know, my YouTube channel, I can see, you know, how many men and how many women are on it watching the videos. And there are a lot of men who key into my channel about narcissistic and other toxic relationships. And I think what typically is most baffling for them is that they don't deal with the outward bullies. They deal with, you know, typically women who are imploding. And so they have sort of a narcissistic quality to them. And whenever the man is not doing what they want them to do, the way they want them to do it, and in their own time, they implode into suicidal ideation, rage, tears. And then, you know, the man is controlled and manipulated by that implosion. So it's kind of doubly baffling. It's sort of the attacking from victim stance that Pia Melody talked about in her work. So that can be really baffling.
Wow. How hard is it to diagnose something like narcissistic personality disorder? I mean, this is definitely a key word and a hot topic that's coming up all over the place. But from what I understand, a lot of people are armchair doctors diagnosing this when it doesn't require a diagnosis.
Absolutely. And in some of my videos on my YouTube channel, Therapist Talks, I do get into the diagnostics. And you know, a lot of people, well, probably everybody has some narcissistic behaviors or traits. And the full-blown disorder is much less common. And there are 9 specific traits, and you have to have at least 5 of them to such a degree that it impacts your life in multiple areas of your life. And so for the most part, people are weaponizing this term and are throwing it around. And oftentimes people who are very narcissistic are throwing it back at their partners to try to disable them, emotionally gaslight them, and again, manipulate and control them. So I think that it's important to look at the way I try to help people understand themselves. And I really encourage people not to try to diagnose somebody else. That's not your job, and it's not where your focus should be. What your focus needs to be is, do I matter in this relationship? Do my thoughts, feelings, wants, and needs matter in this relationship? If they don't, then that's a toxic relationship. Now, if you have collaborated in setting that in motion, which we almost always do, unfortunately, and especially we as women tend to be placators, peacekeepers, and people pleasers, and especially in the early days of a relationship, then we have helped to set that dynamic in motion where our thoughts and feelings and wants and needs don't matter, don't exist, don't come into play, and we don't express them. So if that's the case, then we can show up. We can ask ourselves what we think, feel, want, and need, and start to talk about that and be more totally present in the relationship. And then we get to see what happens. So if that's a really abusive, narcissistic person, they are not going to allow that. And they are going to explode or implode or both. And you're going to see that behavior really escalate. If they really do want you to show up in the relationship, then they will go, oh, wow, it's great to have you show up. So that's where boundaries come in, you know, that we have to stop undermining ourselves with the people pleasing and placating and peacekeeping. And then we get to step back and watch and see what happens. If the manipulation and the bullying and the implosions and explosions escalate, then we know that's a really toxic relationship and we have to get out of it. If that changes the other person and they start to respect and allow you to show up fully, then that's a relationship that can be salvaged.
Such wonderful advice. I was in a relationship like that once. The marriage lasted about 6 months. The divorce took longer than the marriage did.
Oh, gosh.
And I had been so previously traumatized in my life that I kind of took a step back away from having a voice, from having a say in the relationship. And I allowed him to make all the decisions. And when we got married, I started trying to kind of come out of my shell a little bit, which, now, first of all, he married a total stranger, so that's totally on me because I didn't have that personality. And when I started trying to speak up and have a voice in the relationship, he did the implosion. He started threatening suicide every time we would have an argument. And I just wouldn't put up with it anymore. It's like, you know what? This is not healthy. This is not okay. And I'm out.
Good. Good for you.
And also, it was a hard thing to do because I knew that we had just gotten married. We had this nice big wedding. We'd had a lot of people come out for it. And all of a sudden, it was over. And I knew it was over. But having to tell people and having that get out, it was embarrassing.
Yeah.
You know, but my own health and my own safety was more important than that embarrassment.
Absolutely. And that is, you know, that implosion to suicidal ideation, the rage, the victim dance, and all of that is just, you know, the point is to try to get you to behave the way they want you to behave. And then if you don't, then they punish you with all of that behavior. And refusing to behave that way and becoming your own full self is essential. So many people become suicidal in those relationships, genuinely suicidal. And I like to share with them that I believe that it's because you already feel like you don't exist. And so when you then fully exist, that suicidal ideation goes away.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's so nice when it kind of lifts and goes away and you can see clearly again, and you realize, hey, getting out of that was the best thing I could have done for myself. And I've heard that over and over and over and over again. But in the moment, people don't see that.
Right. And part of why we don't see that is we become trauma bonded to that person. So if you think about the cycling between everything going great and everything imploding and exploding, there's this hooking mechanism that happens so that when you're behaving the way they want you to, when you're being manipulated and controlled, then they give you sort of kudos and praise and love, not really love, but love bombing. Right. And then when you don't behave the way they want you to, when you're acting in your true self and your whole self, then they punish you. We become sort of, we're becoming trained and hooked into wanting those breadcrumbs of what we think of as love and wanting to fix ourselves to behave the right way so that we'll get those breadcrumbs. And that's what we call trauma bonded. And so that we are just so hooked by that. So we have to recognize that there are actually different aspects of our brain that are at work. So the trauma bonding happens in the amygdala, that fight, flight, or freeze mechanism in our it's a little walnut-sized thing inside our midbrain, and it's basically what we share with all the other animals. It's our fight, flight, and freeze mechanism. It gives us the strength to get out of a dangerous situation and survive a dangerous situation. But we also have a higher cortex that not all the animals have. But unfortunately, when that amygdala is firing off constantly, that higher cortex is offline. And so in my book, I talk about getting into the clear by recognizing that your wise mind can take over and you can make good decisions from your wise mind instead of that reactive mind. You can recognize I am super attached to this person, but I also know with my wise mind that they are hateful, hurtful, abusive, implosive, explosive, and I have become depressed and anxious and suicidal since I've been with them. and I need to get out, even though my little amygdala thinks I'm in love and thinks I want to keep trying, I'm going to drag myself kicking and screaming out of this relationship. And eventually my little amygdala is going to quiet down and I will stop believing that I love them. And I will start realizing I was attached.
Right. Is there an overlap or correlation between trauma bonding and what a lot of us older folks recognize as being Stockholm syndrome?
It is the same thing. And Stockholm syndrome came into recognition when we saw people who attached themselves to their kidnappers. And so that was sort of a shocking thing that people went, wow, what is that about? And in many ways, a domestic violence relationship is, I did a video called this, they take hostages. They don't, you know, you're not in a relationship, you're a hostage, because you are, you're controlled, you're manipulated, and your behavior is managed by their behavior. So that your thoughts, feelings, wants, and needs don't matter. It's all about them. You have to manage and notice their every whim and mood and flicker of emotion and manage it and placate it constantly, or you get the implosion and explosion.
And they're ugly when they go there.
Oh, yeah. They run the whole gamut too, right?
Oh, my gosh, yes. And this is all kinds of relationships too. It doesn't always have to be a romantic relationship, even though that's what we think about as being the most common. You know, this can also be like parental relationships and friendships and all kinds of stuff can be really manipulative and negative and harmful.
Yeah. Yeah. One of the videos that's getting the most airtime over the last 6 months is when your son or daughter is a narcissist. And so many adults with adult children have these really toxic relationships. And oftentimes what the root was that, you know, there was a relationship. In other words, the parents were in a toxic relationship. Typically the mom leaves the dad, and then of the three kids, one of them is a lot like the dad, you know? And so that has become a really interesting conversation that I've had with many, many of my viewers, and, you know, helping them to learn to set boundaries with their own kids, learn to show up with their own thoughts, feelings, wants, and needs with their own kids, who are shocked because they watched mom get manipulated and controlled by dad all their lives. So why would she now stand up to them? But when, you know, oftentimes when a mom does, sometimes they will respect her. Sometimes they will just explode or implode more. So you never know which direction that's going to go, but you have to be ready to take care of yourself either way.
Right. And I can recognize this. I won't go into too many details, but I can definitely recognize this from my own childhood. My brother turned out to be just like my mom. Mm. And my mom of the two was definitely the more mentally abusive.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. It's crazy. So you mentioned your book, Out of the Fog into the Clear. I love this. And I know you got a copy handy. I'm going to ask you to do a brief reading, but the subtitle is what really grabbed me right away. Mm-hmm. This helped me so much with my own life and understanding my own patterns. And that subtitle is Journaling to Help You Heal from Toxic Relationships. Oh my gosh, just that line alone sends chills down my spine when I realize how much it helped me when I did that exact same thing. So I'm going to let you take it away.
Thanks. Yeah, I did a lot of journaling in my early recovery as well. And I think it's a great way to communicate with yourself and have a back and forth conversation with yourself. So finding yourself in the fog. I've been a lifelong sailor, and dense fog is one of the most terrifying and mystifying things I've ever experienced. It can settle in so gradually that you're not even aware your vision is being obscured, or descend on you so quickly that the sudden complete bleakness is paralyzing. It's just water vapor, after all. What could possibly be so serious about that? But when this happens to you out on the ocean, when the reality hits that you're completely immersed in dense fog, The panic is real. You whirl around in all directions trying to find your bearings, looking for anything that will orient you, and literally you can't see anything but fog. The disorientation is overwhelming. You have no idea where you are, what your boat is doing, where the land or other boats may be, and you know that you are at the whim and will of any danger nearby. Your head pounds, your heart races, your thoughts spin, and you frantically try to grab onto something of substance. But there's nothing in all directions but this thick, dense water vapor, nothing but fog. You can't move for fear of running into something, and even staying still is not safe. This frozen state doesn't help you get out of the fog, but it feels like your only option. So you sit and wait for the fog to lift. In the fog of a hurtful relationship, this feeling of paralysis, anxiety, depression, confusion, disorientation, not knowing who you are or how you got to this dark place in your life is also real. Others may not understand and may even get frustrated with you for not getting out of the relationship. But in this state, only you know how simple that sounds and how hard it really is. The fear, obligation, and guilt crept into your relationship so stealthily that you didn't notice it. The games, the pressures, the gaslighting, the bits of anger, the confusion, the disorientation, all of it was just a bit of water vapor that was easily dismissed. But over the months or years, the fog set in. Abusive relationships are not an act of nature like ocean fog. They're the result of intentional acts of manipulation and control. In the early stages, it's hard to see this for what it is. Unfortunately, the fog of an abusive relationship is not going to just lift. Nothing will change until you change it. So how do you find your bearings, push past this paralysis, clear away your vision, begin to heal the trauma, and rebuild your life? And the next 125 pages will tell you how.
Wonderful. And this is Out of the Fog into the Clear by Shannon Petrovich. This is awesome.
Thank you, Amanda.
And I know there's a link to it on your website, which is nofoggydays.com. I'm going to include all of your links and everything in the description of the podcast. And I always like to end everything on a very positive, very happy note. My favorite question of the whole episode. What is one thing that you absolutely love about yourself that's not related to your physical appearance?
Oh, that's wonderful. I didn't see that one coming. I really love being a very empathic, compassionate person.
I think that shows. It's amazing.
Thank you, Amanda.
A great time it's been having you on the podcast. I really appreciate you and I love what you're doing. And I just want to thank you for all the people that haven't had the voice to be able to thank you for what it is that you're doing.
Well, thank you, Amanda. Your courage in being out there with your survivorship is really inspiring.
Thank you. Sometimes I don't know when to stop.
Don't stop.
If you've enjoyed tonight's episode, please make sure you check out the episode description. There you'll find links on how you can learn more about this guest, links to connect with them on social media, and how to support the podcast. Remember, I don't get paid to do this. My boss is a bit tight-fisted. I can say that. I work for myself. In short, this show really is all about the guest. If you've enjoyed their interview, please feel free to let them know. You can also tune in to my other podcast, Growth from Darkness, which is co-hosted by a lovely lady from Australia. We talk about what trauma responses are and healthy ways to move beyond the past. For more information, just go to growthfromdarkness.com. You can also follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/growthfromdarkness.